Hello and welcome to episode 249 of What Most People Think, and I join you as one of the liberal elite that very much went to the BAFTAs on Sunday night, and I already had a cold, and then I made the fantastic decision to drink on top of a cold because I thought, well, this makes me feel better temporarily, so I must be better. It must be some sort of miracle cure. It was an interesting decision, and I also posted a photo. Rob Beckett was kind enough to let me pose with his BAFTA, and I posted a photo saying, finally, sort of like jokingly indicating that I'd won a BAFTA. And that got taken quite literally, and I had a series of texts yesterday from friends congratulating me. And while hungover and ill, I then had to go through the process of disabusing them of the idea that I'd won a BAFTA, which is obviously preposterous. But it did occur to me, bringing to this week's guest Simon Evans, is that if I did win a BAFTA and I tweeted the words, finally, what kind of dickhead? I mean, that would deserve an immediate punch in the face.
Well, I don't know many comedians who've won BAFTAs. I mainly think of it, I mean, sitcoms win BAFTAs. Is there a stand-up BAFTA? There isn't one, is there?
Not a stand-up. I guess there's like if you host best comedy performance, best light entertainment performance. That's the way that comedians tend to get in. What would your one word post be if you won a BAFTA for something?
Snork. Just good word, you know, use it whenever you can. I've sat in a couple of writing rooms with BAFTAs on the wall. I used to work, I've done a couple of radio shows where people have them up on the shelf, you know, for previous things. I've worked with people who won them for the Office stuff. I think Lee Mack's got a couple. They have a certain kind of, I don't know, I think they dwell quite heavily on your shoulders.
Yeah.
There's a sort of sense, are these my peaks?
Well, I'd imagine that, yeah, for most performers, the thing is the moment when you get it is amazing, right? But it's very, all this stuff is very temporary for comics. So the following day, you just immediately think, well, how do I get that feeling again? We never stop.
No.
I mean, it'd be a great thing to just have at home, you know, for dinner parties and stuff like that. But we all know that the real achievements in comedy are things, if there was a trophy that just said, did regular weekends at the store, we know that doing regular weekends at the Comedy Store is a hard thing to get and sustain. But sadly, they don't give out trophies for that.
But you see those trophies on the faces of your peer group, Jeff. That's all that matters, is the admiration, the confidence they have of sharing a bill with you.
Was trusted to close the late show.
Yeah, yeah. While everyone else went home. Right, see you, Simon. We know you're in safe hands here. Yeah. I've got a mate in Brighton called Johnny Byrne who did the sound engineering, not like a composer, but the sound engineering for Zone of Interest and won the Oscar for that and the BAFTA. And he had a party and he had a little sort of photo booth arrangement where you could get your photo taken with the awards. And I have to say the BAFTA is a much more impressive award than the Oscar. The Oscar looks like you bought it at Timpsons when you hold it. It's got a real sort of fairground vibe to it. I mean, it is heavy, but it looks like it's hollow plastic. It looks like it's been plastic molded, you know.
One of my first thoughts when holding the BAFTA was that it was heavy enough to cost someone to death with. I think that maybe there's something in that, is that, you know, it's supposed to recognise your contribution to the arts. But actually, what a way to go, though, if you was a burglar and then you realised you were getting done in with
the dent on their forehead.
Is actually the imprint of the BAFTA face. It appears that he was killed by a tiny man who was kissing him very firmly. Well, we will, subsequent to the BAFTA talk, there's plenty that's been going on politically in the last week. I don't know if you guys saw, but on Monday, yesterday, as we're recording this, Rishi Sunak gave a big speech. It was sort of like an election-style speech. And the sort of main focus of it was ostensibly on defence, but there was other stuff in there too, including the fact that he said that he thought Keir Starmer was just trying to depress people into voting for Labour, which I thought was quite a funny line. He is, and they might. Also reflected a bit on the slightly in-and-out week for Keir Starmer, because rewind to Wednesday, and he was welcoming Natalie Elphick as another defector, and he was grinning like a Cheshire cat, which I've suddenly thought might be rhyming slang. Oh, no, Cheshire cats actually do look like they've got a grin, but it could also be.
Well, a Cheshire cat is a character in Alice in Wonderland. It's not an actual cat.
But it does sound like, you Cheshire. It sounds like something Danny Dyer would say, you fucking Cheshire.
What would the cat rhyme with, though? It's a boring end one, isn't it?
I was thinking twat. I mean, let's just put it out there. Cheshire cat, twat, yes. There we go. We found our level for this episode. We might also talk in and among that about the good economic news that slipped out and got precious little attention, but solid quarter one growth. And then we're going to discuss Baby Reindeer. Now, it's this hit Netflix show you might have heard. It's sort of surfing the cultural zeitgeist at the moment. But I had an interesting experience on a writing project recently where I just wondered if some of the way that we've approached this, because the story is about a woman stalking a man, is slightly different than if it was the other way around. And in the Patreon only, we'll be looking off a couple of high-profile boycotts to do with what's going on in the Middle East and Gaza's more specifically, and look what the criteria for what people are calling genocide, what that currently is, and how possibly this whole movement is sort of catnip for, not catnip, like they're not enjoying it.
Cheshire catnip.
Cheshire catnip, yeah. It's certainly, there's a generation that certainly in the US in particular, that have jumped onto this with no small measure of enthusiasm. New patrons. We've got three new ones this week, Simon. I think the first one is one we'll both be able to get our teeth into. Jim Hooker. I mean, that is the most... I know we've had a few detective names recently, but that is your archetypal...
Yeah, from the 70s, I think. I like it, yeah. Jim Hooker. He's probably... he's ex-services, isn't he, I think? And he's certainly handy, yeah.
Yeah.
Or is it handsy?
Handy and handsy. It's Jim Hooker. Yeah, it would have been one of those guys. Do you remember when we saw shows when we were like younger and in the 80s, there were still guys that would talk about having served in Vietnam as well? So
what, you think he's American? He's like Rockford Files. I was watching for long involved reasons to do with my Edinburgh show this year. I was watching some old Alias Smith and Jones from the late 60s, early 70s, and there were some names to conjure with there because you had the actor and then his real character's name and then the Alias Smith, like a fantastic box set of names in every episode.
Has it stood the test of time well?
Well, it was basically a TV version of Butch and Sundance, wasn't it? And yeah, it was glorious, absolutely. For me, that like set the model of what all male friendship should be based on.
Grumpiness.
The cunning silver-tongued devil, and the other one should be the sort of strong, silent, but fast with the gun. And I decided early on I needed a gunslinging mate.
A wingman or a man-at-arms.
Yeah.
We got Morgan Proverbs. Morgan Proverbs, clearly a made-up name. I would say unless you're a child of a rock star who married an actress, that is quite plausibly from the womb of Gwyneth Paltrow, Morgan Proverbs. Although it could be like, you know, the grime scene is now so well entrenched in British culture, it's now got loads of different subcultures. This could be one of the more thoughtful grime artists, Morgan Proverbs.
Yeah, could be. Well, totally out of my comfort zone there, if you're right. I've never heard the word Proverbs as a surname, but I like it.
Yeah, it does work as a name, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if it is your sort of stage name, you're setting yourself up to be quite proverbial, isn't it, in your pronouncements,
yeah,
you know,
quite,
to be
yeah,
quite
yeah,
pithy and memorable. It's not easy to come out with more than one or two a day, I would say.
Well, it's like that old thing with girls' names. Girls' names are quite aspirational in terms of quality. So, like, calling a girl Harmony that can't sing.
Yeah.
Calling yourself Morgan Proverbs if you're inarticulate would be a shame, wouldn't it?
Calling a girl Dawn, I always felt, was like putting too much pressure on it. It's a nice thing. It was quite a popular name when I was growing up. But, you know, yeah, just some girls are just not Dawn-like.
Yeah, yeah. Summer.
Yeah, yeah. I think girls' names are, I don't mind them at all but I do think, you know, when they're little girls and they're flouncing around in their Disney, you know, princess outfits, yeah, and they're called Persephone or whatever. But I do think, and maybe with blokes as well, at the age of 12, it should be quite normal to go, right, do you now want a new name?
Yes, yeah.
How are we feeling about this? When you hit puberty, you come out the other side, you're clearly not the same thing. When I look at pictures now, my son's 16, when I look at pictures of him from before he was 12,
yeah,
it's just clearly a completely different entity entirely. You know, the idea that he carries the same name with him is sort of ridiculous.
That is a great idea. Like, should you be allowed to have a name review at a certain age? Different names would demand different ages. I would say that if you're a hunched 92-year-old woman who's just finding life difficult generally, being called Summer, especially if you're quite waspish, hey, Summer's in the room, everybody, and she kind of like ambles in and just tells everyone to fuck off.
Very much an Indian Summer at that point.
Yeah, yeah. She could become an Autumn then. You know, she could move through the seasons. But yeah, should people be able to pick their own names? We've also got Adam Cornish.
It's the opposite of Joe Buxton, isn't it?
Adam Buxton and Joe Cornish. We've got Adam Cornish. As somebody actually got, they've basically melded the DNA of these two. Fuck, that would be a good podcast, wouldn't it? Domain talking point, our super patron, David Domain. We also, by the way, we had a letter. I was talking about politicians as nuts. Suella Braverman last week called Keir Starmer, said he had the charisma of a peanut. And I contested that. Actually, peanuts probably, they've got a bit about them, peanuts. You know, they hang out in pubs. You know, they're around at parties.
They've got riz.
They've got the riz, the charisma. You can't say you don't know grime and then know the word riz. To listeners, riz is a youth word, which I think is a truncation of charisma. I think it's actually a really good word. You know, words come out and yeah, it just means like a lad that's got the charisma. He's got the riz. He's got the riz. So look, if you're a lady listening to this and you've been married a few years, just look at your partner there dozing on the couch and ask yourself, does he have the riz? Has he ever had the riz?
If you were to remake Jesus Christ Superstar now, I think there'd be a song where Judas Iscariot would say that Jesus has the riz.
Yes, yeah.
It feels like that could be the new title, in fact.
I was just jealous of his riz. He was rizzing up Mary Magdalene.
That's a different meaning entirely.
Danny Peters has sent in a letter saying that he thinks Keir Starmer is a macadamia because other people seem to inexplicably rate them highly, but I think they're a bit soft and light on actual policy. I mean flavour. Yeah, macadamia. It's a bit sophisticated. I think it would be a very basic nut if he was a nut. And David Domain, our super patron, I used the word curate's egg last week. It's one of those phrases that you always feel quite intelligent when used, and I doubted myself. And so he gave a bit of background as to where the phrase comes from. He said in May 1895, a satirical British magazine called Judy published a cartoon by the artist Wilkerson depicting a curate and an austere bishop at breakfast in the bishop's house. The bishop says, "Dear me, I'm afraid your egg's not good." The curate, not wishing to offend his host and superior, meekly replies, "Oh, yes, my lord, really, some parts of it are very good." Did you know that as a source of curate's egg?
The line is, "I assure you, my lord, some parts of it are excellent." I'm sure that's the actual line.
Is it excellent? Is there a pun there?
No, not a pun, just excellent. But I'm surprised it was in that magazine. I thought it was in Punch. Maybe he redid it. Maybe he sold it to several different magazines. But yeah, that's the... So what it means, a curate's egg means it's fundamentally bad, and you're desperately trying to find some way of diminishing your disappointment with it. So, yeah, curate's egg is... Yeah. People usually use it now to mean something that is good in parts and you know, some aspects of it. Probably a Netflix series that's worth watching as long as you can get past the annoying casting of a lesbian of colour in what was originally a white bloke in the book or something, you know. You know what I mean? It's something that can be irritating, but actually it's all right. The original meaning was not that. The original meaning was something that people were trying to palm off as okay, because obviously if you've got a rotten egg, you've got a rotten egg, and there's no working around that.
Yeah, I mean, it's also one of those phrases that if you want to feel intelligent, you might just say. It's like sometimes I'll just throw the phrase supply-side reform when I'm doing a bit of radio news review.
Supply-side is a killer, isn't it? It's an absolutely, like, eliminates 90% of the opposition at a stroke.
Yeah, again, well, they said some good stuff on supply-side reform, you know, and there's a lot of good connective tissue between the policy.
Can I say something about nuts and charisma?
You can.
I don't think most people would be able to distinguish if, like, macadamia, cashew, but a lot of nuts are not that different from one from another, except in their shape, the outward appearance, the sort of size of them. Peanuts are always heavily salted and sometimes a bit of vinegar, which gives them some vim. The key thing with nuts is to roast and salt them well. And that, I think, is there's a potential there for a very useful political metaphor, because that's what we're worried about with Starmer.
Yes.
Is that it doesn't matter whether he's a macadamia or a pea or a Brazil. The question is, has he been roasted and salted, or are we just sort of getting
a good nut point.
Straight from, yeah, this is the worry.
I mean, he doesn't know if he's a macadamia or Brazil nut, really. That's the point. He has no idea what kind of nut he is. And yeah, that ties in very, very neatly with his acceptance of Natalie Elphick in the part. I mean, she's a very different kind of nut entirely, but he doesn't seem to care. What most people think. Okay, we're going to do a quick thank you and a fuck you. I'll do the thank you. It's to the audience at the Tunbridge Wells Book Festival. I went there last Friday and it hadn't sold like spectacularly well, but then I don't know why suddenly there were people there and we had a good chat. And the book, The British Bloke Decoded, the paperback, for those of you that just don't want to lug stuff around, but you've got holidays coming up. It's out on June the 6th. You can get it on Amazon or Waterzones. It's a new book thing for the kids. Waterzones. You get in their Riz section, get Rizzed up with The British Bloke Decoded. And it's basically, if you like the way that I talk about gender and relationships on this podcast, then you're going to enjoy it. I mean, that was a bit too confident. I actually annoyed myself the way I said that. You're going to enjoy it. Aaron, Simon can do the fuck you. What are you angry with this week, mate?
I'm going to fuck you to Apple and to Tim Cook for an ad he put up online, which was, I don't think, ever released onto TV or anything. It was withdrawn, but it showed dozens of beautiful musical instruments, traditional tools for artists, paints and brushes and so on, an old-fashioned record player, a gramophone, and a metronome, and various other artifacts and instruments and tools of art and creative endeavor being crushed in a hydraulic press and turned into the thinnest ever Apple iPad Pro. And it was obviously quite a clever, I understand, quite a clever construct, but I think it was just too vividly on the nose about what precisely everyone is worried about in terms of the degree to which, not actually necessarily Apple's hardware, but more artificial intelligence recently does seem to be encroaching on what are traditionally means through which human beings have expressed themselves. There was a near universal outpouring of a reaction of loathing towards this thing, and Cook recoiled and pulled the ad, which is great. So I suppose the fuck you is a little bit late because they have mea culpa. But nevertheless, I wanted to raise it.
No, I think a lot of people won't have seen the advert that you're talking about. I mean, just to play sort of devil's advocate with my curate's egg and my supply sites, is that it was honest. I mean, that is what's good about smartphones and iPads. I can remember, like, not long ago, going out to do a tour show, and I would have to take my iPod with me, and I would have to take my sat nav with me and my phone, and they all had different chargers.
Yeah,
and it was like I had to take a separate rucksack for.
I like the fact you're going back to the point at which everything was down to three separate Apple products.
Yes,
not the guitar and the camera. Yeah, yeah. You remember when you used to have an iPad and an iPod? Oh my goodness! Oh my god!
That is where observational humour goes. If Peter Kay was becoming Peter Kay now, he's going, who remembers Garmin's? Who remembers that original? Remember. Before TomTom, you remember that? You could leave house without your TomTom. You wouldn't know where you're going.
It's true. Nobody remembers maps.
Well, you know, like, it's the same way for me is, you know, like, the people talk about the death of the high street. We all like to believe that we're great supporters of the high street, but we've all been complicit in its downfall. Is the problem that it sort of reminded us of our own complicity in this change?
No, I think all the problem was, to be honest, I do applaud the fact that iPad is an extraordinarily powerful creative tool, but I don't think you want to kill all those things. What they should have done in exactly the same message could have been demonstrated as somebody showed by throwing the advert backwards and just showing this is what we've compressed into all this. But it was the actual visceral destruction. It was watching a trumpet being crushed. It was watching piano splintering. It was watching paint just being, dispersed. It was really, like, unnecessarily grim and fascist. It had very short... And the very first famous TV commercial for Apple was 1984-based, Big Brother, she swings the hammer, the girl is like, releasing creativity. It had that horrible feeling, like, Apple have turned into the, we demand uniformity to all your products.
It does sort of remind you, like, this is how much you rely on us now. You know what? We got rid of all that stuff and we fucking enjoyed it. All right, so we're talking from Apple destroying things to Rishi reminding us that war is imminent. So Rishi's been trying to get on the front foot. I mean, it just feels like that could be a sort of multi-purpose headline for the last, since he's been leader. And so he did a big speech on Monday, whereby the main purpose of it seemed to be to drive a wedge issue between him and Labour. So he basically outlined that we're in a dangerous and changing world and that he's willing to pledge to a certain level of finance for the military and Labour aren't. And it would seem in all the poll things, basically the public trusts Labour more on almost everything, whereas defence is perhaps the one area where the Tories are still ahead. First up, why do you think he's gone for defence? I mean, obviously there's the electoral thing, but is there another implied thing here, Simon? It's like, oh, it's dangerous out there. The other lot, we haven't been ideal, but we are the devil and we are in your contact book.
Well, it's certainly plausible. I think you've got to accept that. It's plausible that we could be looking at war spreading west from Ukraine in the next decade. It's plausible that there could be serious, quasi-terrorist responses, I suppose, to the ongoing situation in the Middle East, although the British government has really got a fairly minor role to play in that at the moment. I think most people are aware that there has been an escalation of threat level generally. And I think the Tories probably, although I would say under Johnson more than under Rishi, did demonstrate a certain amount of fortitude and conviction and unambivalent allyship when things got nasty in Ukraine. That was quite a that was probably you know, one of the more shining hours of the Tory administration. So it does feel plausible. And yes, generally speaking, Blair in Iraq aside, Labour governments have on the whole been understood to be less committed to NATO, less committed to you know, an American dominated imperial post-Cold War world order. So I suppose there's a sort of nostalgia there as well that they can play back into the idea that Harold Wilson is a Kremlin agent and so on. Some of these little ghosts never completely die, do they?
But that's the problem, is will that land with the public? Because when I look at Starmer, I see a bloke that I think would love a bit little war somewhere. I think that he's got that in it. Well, you know, he's quite sort of like conservative with a small C. He ran the CPS. He likes a bit of law and order, you know.
What about David Lammy as foreign secretary, though?
Well, this is the problem in a way. Is I think that the public, if he's trying to pin that on Starmer, he might have difficulty. But like the idea of what is behind him, I think that's the plausible thing, is that the Labour Party didn't suddenly change overnight with the appointment of Keir Starmer. And let's be honest, Keir Starmer has changed a lot since he's been he's been leader too. That was what was interesting, was that the things that landed most out of this, because as you say, at the very least, what Rishi's doing is sort of pledging to fund the military to a point that was already promised quite a long time ago and then actually reduced for a while. Is he sort of used it as a Trojan horse to make other criticisms? He seemed to have a good way of articulating his grasp on a subject. You know, like, I think that in terms of making an argument, he slightly has the edge on Starmer. The phrase about Starmer depressing the voters into voting for Labour. I mean, there's definitely that feeling that Starmer sort of seems to feel like he should just inherit this rather than make a particularly specific play from it. But there was this other thing where they were sort of, which may, for me, have been a better way of focusing it, was he was talking about the positives. And there was some, you know, a lot of people say, well, what have the Tories done in 14 years in power? Apparently, we're the fourth largest exporter. At the moment, it's very hard to credit good news about Britain, isn't it?
The fourth largest exporter within the United Kingdom.
Yeah. In the world.
I find that very, I didn't see that. I'd like to dig into that a bit. Chris Snowden wrote a brilliant, absolutely scathing account of Tory meddling in futile, trivial activities in The Critic this week, which anyone who has access to online world should.
We may well top that index, meddling. We are the number one.
Absurd levels of meddling in just in, you know, whether or not it's legal to eat dogs and things like that nobody wants to do.
The busybody index.
I do think the economy, the manufacturing sector, you know, aside the, you know, financial services and more sort of abstract aspects to British business these days. But the economy is not in as bad shape as everyone kind of feels it is. I think that is a weird, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so this is the problem, is it's when it's a feeling, it's very hard to land these things. And there was other stuff too, like, you know, we've overtaken France as the seventh largest manufacturer. Again, a lot of people will be surprised, flatly reject it, angry even at that. earnings rising, still outpacing inflation. Since 2010, we've been the fastest growing economy in Europe. Now, some people might legitimately say a lot of that was pre-Brexit and the trajectory might not be the same, but that would still surprise people. We're one of only three countries to have $1 trillion tech sector, along with, I think it's the USA and China.
That is good, because it's quite interesting how badly Europe as a whole, including Britain, has been left behind in the last 10 years by America on tech, and how America versus China is seen as the major, you know, that's the only narrative really that people are interested in. And America is basically sucking in huge waves of Indian immigration into San Francisco in order to support its tech sector, what's happening in ours. But I do think we actually underestimate that. I think Britain still has a lot to offer on that front. My wife just so happens to work in the biotech sector. She had a contract to work for Kate Bingham during the vaccine task force era, and so sort of drifted into that. And it's extraordinary how low-key some of this stuff is, considering how, you know, how much of a world leader Britain is. We are incredibly used to just kind of laughing at ourselves. A bit of self-deprecation never goes amiss. But unfortunately, the Tories are in no, I don't know, they just don't seem to be able to harness that, as you say, to create any kind of sense of optimism and positivity. We seem to go on. I remember when Labour came in, and a lot of people talk nowadays and recognise and understand that to a large extent, when Tony Blair came in 97, a huge part of the optimism that buoyed him aloft was like the economic circumstances that Ken Clark had delivered in the last few years of the Tory administration. But even so, there was a massive feel-good factor, and it carried him an awful long way, all the way through, essentially, to the big crash. since that crash, I don't remember a feel-good factor existing at all since 2010. No. I just hasn't. We've never had a moment where we've gone, ah, here we go. Now it's working. Maybe for about a week after the Scottish referendum, you know, we went, good, that's behind us. You know, now let's crack on.
There's folk songs written about that time. The glorious week of May, that's when the birds were singing and the pound was arising.
Yes, and the gulls were a-swooping.
I mean, that was another argument that he sort of said. It was reminded, this is their story can't not involve the fact they came into power after the financial crash.
Yeah.
There was Brexit. There was a pandemic. There's war in Europe. There's rising gas prices. All of this stuff, I think the public probably actually go, yep, all of that stuff, but no, still pissed off. Because if people feel poorer, it's very hard for them not to feel angry. And, you know, just as a last thing on this, I mean, the news of the GDP, which outstripped expectation, actually GDP is up per capita. I think it was outstripped the US in the first quarter. It just floated across the news screens, really. If you think how prominent bad economic news is, and I'm not saying this is just because they're the Tory government. This is something I've remembered throughout my life. It is so weird how little appetite people have for good news. It just, no one gives a fuck.
It's absolutely true. And of course, even America, I mean, America have become much wealthier than Britain, but their debt is unbelievable. Admittedly, they're able to support that debt because, you know, they remain, you know, the dollar remains the default petrodollar and all the rest of it. But it is an extraordinary amount of debt that supports their economic success. You know, we cannot compete with that. So it's ridiculous to look to that as a comparison. But yeah, you're absolutely right. We do enjoy, you know, a lot of benefits and yet nobody feels it. I mean, personally, I don't know where this podcast stands on this. I think lockdown was a disgrace and I think it was badly handled. And I think Boris Johnson's instincts were much better. And I also think, for what it's worth, I'll just stick this in here, if they'd stuck with Johnson, I mean, he made his own bed to a large extent, but I reckon if they'd stuck with him as leader, they'd be in a much stronger position. There is no way they would be as absolutely hobbled in the polls now, regardless of whether you think he was morally culpable or deserved to go. But his instincts were right over lockdown. I think that would have relieved the economic burden. Or just imagine if we weren't paying off for the debt we incurred there. You know, and to combine that with net zero at the same time is just an incredible burden. The fact that we're even above water at all is quite extraordinary.
That's what they should say. The fact that we're even above water at all is, given all the shit that's happened, there's a new slogan idea. All right, we're going to talk about Keir Starmer now. So Natalie Elphick, this has been big news. She crossed the floor of the House of Commons and it was sort of so unexpected that she sort of looked like she'd accidentally put her handbag down there last night and was going to retrieve it. Everyone's like, what? Who the fuck is that, Natalie? What's she doing? Now, what made this interesting was she's a definitively right-wing Tory MP. I understand that she has some stuff on housing that's a bit more nuanced, but well, she certainly operates like the kind of more in the Lee Anderson type role. You know, she's a more willing to go on the front foot and attack certain cultural issues and contentious issues like immigration. And initially, this was hailed as a big win for Labour, you know, because she's her seat is Dover. She's on the front line in the migrant boats crisis, illegal immigration crisis. And the Labour was sort of crowing a bit. I mean, I think that Keir Starmer even annoyed his own fans a bit with this because he was just a bit too pleased by half with this. He was just, there was something about the look on his face. He was like, oh, hello, not just one new MP, but two, look, what's, is that Natalie Elphick? Look what the cat dragged it. You know, he just, it was sort of reminded you of two really annoying things about Keir Starmer. Is one, that a lot of the good things that happen for him aren't orchestrated by him. And secondly, that he, and this is a bigger problem for him with his, in his own party, is that he just doesn't seem to have a fixed set of principles. Like, as people have pointed out, you know, whatever you think about Diane Abbott, she's had this disciplinary process that's been going on. I mean, basically, they're just trying to kick it beyond the next election, right? Because they know it could be damaging for the party. And so that goes on for ages. But then within a fucking heartbeat, somebody who's had a lot of policies which would go squarely against the Labour ethos, she's directly criticised Starmer, you know, very literally a day before there was a leaflet with her name on it saying that he doesn't have a plan for the migrant boats crisis. And then just to basically own the Tories, he dispatches all of that and welcomes her across. So did it blow up in his face a little bit?
I mean, I don't know how much most people will pay attention to this. I suspect it will be gone in most people's minds within a week. I don't think I'd heard of Natalie Elphick, if I'm honest. If you'd asked me before a couple of weeks ago, I doubt I'd have been able to pick her out of a lineup. I'm aware that she's got a checkered past, not just in her policies, but also in attempting, I think, to secure better treatment for her husband, who had to resign his seat after plausible allegations of sexual assault and so on. It's all very muddy.
And then was convicted, yeah.
You know, she's apologised for that, but that's pretty dodgy. You know, I don't think there's any room in Parliament for anyone who's in that position, to be honest. I'm surprised that she still has a career. And also, I will just note it, that she made some remarks about Marcus Rashford, which were almost word for word the same as those which saw Andrew Lawrence booted out of the comedy world, you know, and unable to tour after the penalties in the Euro.
Maybe stick to football instead of the activism.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I do think it exposes Starmer's moral vacuum. Emptiness, his sort of bland, plausible face, but it does, I suppose, also show. Politics is a mucky game, but they gain nothing from it. As I understand it, she's not even standing in the next election anyway. It's not like they're going to give her a good seat, or she's hoping to bring her constituency with her.
Well, yeah, so she said that she's not standing. And then the initial presumption was that she'd been guaranteed a place in the Lords by Starmer. And then they sort of did this fudge whereby we haven't made that offer. And they're like, yet. That you're almost hearing this kind of silent yet. And I wonder if there was a long game in mind here. One, which was that it gave the opportunity for Starmer to look more plausible on immigration. Then they had this set piece thing together on the Wednesday where he laid out his plan for immigration, which a lot of his stuff that's already happening. But that was when the GDP news was landing, right? So I wondered if they just got a little bit too political about this and never thought that there's actually a limit that you could push Labour MPs to. I mean, somebody like Jess Phillips and the work that she does in terms of sexual violence against women, you know, to have somebody walk over to the other side who essentially was a party to the poo-pooing of victims. I mean, at one point she did imply that the only reason the women made these allegations against her husband was because he was rich and famous and good-looking or something.
She's as bad as Hillary Clinton.
I mean, like, also, I've seen photos of him. I mean, both of those things were a little bit of a stretch, but certainly by no means the worst of his crimes is his face. And it's sort of a reminder with Starmer how much has come to him rather than how much he's driven. I mean, he's shown poor political judgments before. You know, a lot of people on the left are still angry with him about what he said about Israel on LBC, where he essentially implied that it was okay to hold a siege and to cut off food and water. He definitely fucking said it, by the way. Like, however much they try and row back on that, his initial support for the candidate in Rochdale, who said awful anti-Semitic things about the October 7th terrorist attacks. There was his botched reshuffle where he tried to sack Angela Rayner and ended up giving her about 17 jobs.
As far as I'm concerned, it's all there in that photo of him with Angela Rayner, you know, in his office taking the knee. As soon as I saw that, I mean, he's never forced me to revisit my judgment on him after that.
But the point is, he's not consistent now, is that he did that then. And if you asked him to do it now, he would have an argument as to why you shouldn't do it. That's the point.
That's my point. He's a what do you call it? A straw in the wind, not a candle in the wind. That would be.
He's a straw in the wind.
I mean, he's going to die.
He's a peanut. He's a macadamia. He's every nut. I've got to be honest, this week I started to look at him and I've tried to be open-minded, but I think I don't like the bloke. I actually don't like the bloke. If you look at his career, like, you know, head of the CPS, and then what he did, you know, to stay in the shadow cabinet, he went back and worked with Corbyn, tried to get him elected twice. Then he become, you know, he has his position on Brexit, which then he completely reverses. He, you know, made promises in the Labour election thing that he's completely reversed. There is now quite a long litany of charges against him, which I think that the Tories...
99% of men have a penis.
Yeah, on gender ideology, he's been a bit inconsistent. So it's no longer like a paperweight charge against him. And I just wonder how much the Tories are sitting on in a campaign sense to kind of lay this out to the public, for whom a lot of them won't be aware, like you say, that he is this flaky. But look, there will be Starmer fans listening, and I've probably pissed you off this week. So if you want to take me to task on anything I've said about the great man himself, who definitely has created this polling, it wasn't just given to him. He's a political equivalent of having inherited a fucking trust fund. So if that annoys you, email whatmostpeoplethinkuk@gmail.com. Right, we're going to talk about the show Baby Reindeer now. So this is one of these sort of zeitgeisty shows that you would have probably become aware of this phrase or word, even if you haven't watched the show. And it's a show that's on Netflix. It's with the Scottish comedian Richard Gadd. And it's been a hit, you know, and it's their number one Netflix show in English-speaking territories for several weeks. And it's basically about a guy who is stalked by a woman. And there's another story of sexual abuse in it. But the principal sort of bit of the story is that that's, you know, what he underwent in his life. It says at the beginning, this is a true story, not even based on a true story. This is a true story. And it turns out it really was, because if you, even if you just search the phrases used in some of the tweets and messages that this woman sent him, people were able to quickly find out her identity. So it's been a big thing in the news. I mean, the phrase baby reindeer has already become part of the cultural lexicon, where once Bunny Boiler existed, you could now potentially say she's gone a bit baby reindeer. Have you seen the show, Simon?
I'm afraid not. My wife and son, I've got a 16-year-old son, they watched it one night. They watched sort of two or three episodes, and she said she not just didn't want to watch it anymore, she actually actively hated it.
Right, okay.
I have no interest in it at all. I've never seen Richard Gadd live. Everything I've heard about this show makes it sound like everything I hate in TV drama.
No, this is a good position to be. Well, but what was interesting, I did watch it. I've got to say, I found it compelling. And maybe it's because it was so obviously a true story. And there's questions about...
Well, it's
about-
not, though, is it? She didn't go to jail. She wasn't arrested. You know, there's a big question over whether he could be sued if she had been given the name. I mean, has he covered it up? Has he fictionalised it enough?
No, I don't think he has. And also, you know, it sort of brings to light the idea that Netflix compliance is the wild fucking West. They're just not regulated in the same way, which seems... It seems a bit sort of hamstring. You've got the poor old BBC plugging away there with a fucking huge legal department, and Netflix just going, yeah, it's fine. It's fine. Just throw it out there. You know, no such thing as bad press. Well, it turns out that there might be. And one of the reasons I wanted to discuss it was because I was working on a project recently where we wanted to make a joke about baby reindeer. And some of the feedback that we got was that, look, the cultural tide has turned on this. There's a vulnerable person involved, and there's a duty of care to protect that person. Now, all fair enough, all noble. It did make me think that the dynamic of this has been very different because it was a woman stalking a man. I wonder in the TV industry where anyone would even have thought of that if it was a guy that stalked a woman over that kind of period of time. It's partly what's interesting about the show is it's created these difficult cultural debates. You know, the fact that there's even any hesitancy about her welfare in all of this, this lady that's come to light and been on Piers Morgan. I just don't know. I think it would be uniform. If it was a bloke, it'd be, this guy is a piece of shit. You wouldn't even get on the Piers Morgan show.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. If a bloke stalks a woman, it's understood, as long as the case lands, there's the obvious threat of physical violence, intimidation. It can end up with murder. You know, that is a major difference, yeah. Whereas when a woman stalks a man, it is basically a question of her, as you say, being a bunny boiler. It is a question of her, you know, making the man's wife or family think that he has encouraged her. That's the sort of problem, isn't it? Which is obviously a different sort of tier. So then you're into sort of psychological questions of as to who has the responsibility for maintaining trust in a relationship and so on. You know, it's a slightly different level of threat.
It is a different level of threat. And I fully accept that, you know, if you look at the amount of women that are murdered by men that they know, you know, there is a cultural sort of prism through which you have to view this. But if you take it at face value on the effect on his life, you know, if you just took the exact same parameters of the story and transposed it, obviously the threat would be different physically. I just think it's been interesting to watch it play out. You know, I think that, I mean, the rumours are that this lady was paid a hell of a lot of money to go on Piers Morgan. The idea that you would financially be comfortable in the media space of rewarding somebody in some way financially for what they are even accused to have done, it does seem like a double standard.
Well, I don't know. It's a mucky business, isn't it? It sounds to me like Richard Gadd has been financially rewarded for slandering the woman, like to an extraordinary extent. I mean, financially rewarded to an extraordinary extent. But I haven't seen this show and I don't know how much he's distorted the events. But I think once somebody's gone there with it, once somebody's signed a check or a contract to exploit it, then it's fair game for the other side to exploit it as much as they can as well, you know, to put their own case. I don't want to call it trial by TV. I mean, I don't suppose he's kind of saying, I demand justice. He's just kind of going, oh, here's an interesting drama you might want to watch. But it does kind of feel to me like she has every right to say, well, hang on, now everyone knows this is supposed to be me. You know, here's my version of it. And I don't know how many, you know, but if it's, as you say, the biggest and most popular show on Netflix, I imagine Gadd has been fairly well remunerated.
Well, you know, I agree. I just wonder if we would even culturally allow that if the roles had been reversed on a gender level. And interestingly, you mentioned about sort of like culpability. In the show, Richard Gadd's character repeatedly sort of say, he sort of tacitly acknowledges that he might have led it on at points. And again, I just don't think that that would be something that would be deemed to be, you know, problematic if it were the other way around, because it's a bloke and a woman. So yeah, it is. I mean, the best we could say, this is an incredibly murky area. So all I'm saying is a bit of advice to listeners. If you're in an HR meeting, do not say she went a bit baby reindeer. Never go full baby reindeer. And it, as it was pointed out to me this week, it does also sound like the top kids show on Netflix as well. I mean, how many kids might have clicked on that? Oh, that sounds, what is that, like Baby Dinosaur? Is it part from that cinematic universe? Listen, Simon, man, as ever, thanks so much for coming on the show. Are you out touring at the moment? What should we be going to?
Yeah, I'd be, if anyone just wants to Google my website, it's called The Simon Evans, or just Google my name, you'll find it. And I am touring. It's slightly sporadic. I'm touring in the summer, or up until Edinburgh. I'm touring in the autumn, and there's some few dates going in for the next spring. In Edinburgh this year at the Fringe, I'll be doing something a bit different, something more in line with my Simon Evans Goes to Market radio series. I'm doing some talks, hopefully funny and informative in equal measure, on Adam Smith, David Hume, the Scottish Enlightenment, the aftermath of all of that, so on. Two talks, one in the afternoon, one early evening, a venue called Panmure House, which was Adam Smith's residence in Edinburgh. So I'm in the midst of writing those at the moment, but I'm looking forward to that, something a bit different.
What time, as there is probably some sort of Venn diagram between our audiences, what time are you going? Because I know that my guys, they do not want to be out after 7 p.m. So are you forcing them out after the witching hour? Are you doing one of those cool early days?
I think one of it is 3 p.m. and the other one's, I think the other one is about 7 p.m. Yeah, maybe 6:30.
Okay,
yeah.
You're pushing it with 3 p.m. You're fucking laughing, mate. 7 p.m. you're pushing it. You might have to hand out stimulants on the way in.
They'll have to take their baby reindeer to keep them company.
Listen, Simon Evans, thanks so much for coming back on What Most People Think, and we will be back with another show next week.